There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Textory. If you don't know what it is and why you're here, how do you even get here? Textory is a podcast where we read historical texts and we dissect them and we react to them and we get some splendid historical tea. So if that's your vibe, stay with me. Also, if you want to support the podcast, I have a Patreon at patreon.com/textory where I post stuff like unpublished things that didn't make it into the episode or books that I've read or other stuff that I think is pretty cool. So go check that out. Today, we will be talking consumption. Yay! I have to say, to me, the early Victorian era is very gothic. It could be because I am an avid reader of the Bronte sisters. They're probably my favorite writers. And I am a sucker for Jane Eyre mainly, but also A Tenant of Wiltfell Hall, all of that stuff. I love it. Jane Eyre was published in 1847. So for me, that association of like very ghostly, very murky vibes, that's basically the first decades of Victoria's time on the throne. I just always thought it feels very dark and very gothic. I think it also has to do with the vibes of the Industrial Revolution. It just seems like a very unhealthy time to be alive with, you know, all the fumes and all the smoke and the poor ventilation and no regulations regarding the pollution and the child mortality spiking and doctors barely even knowing what they're doing. Also, cities were a mess at the time. You barely had any sanitation. Everything was completely overcrowded. We've actually covered this in an episode about Victorian Edinburgh, which if you want to check it out, that was season 1, episode 14. And because of that, consumption just spread like wildfire in that time. And because consumption, or tuberculosis, which is the modern name for it, it spreads through droplets. When an infected person sneezes or when an infected person coughs. And, you know, 10 people living in a single room didn't help much. So that was what made it even worse. So as I said, the air was polluted and also people didn't like opening their windows too much because they also feared that the disease could be coming from the outside. A lot of people being malnourished and just in poor physical condition because of how much work they had to do. You basically get a recipe for disaster when you add all of this together. It is actually estimated that at its peak, tuberculosis was responsible for a quarter of all deaths in Europe, or some people even say it could have been a third of all deaths in Europe, which is crazy. So no wonder that when we say tuberculosis or when we say consumption, the Romantic era and the Victorian era come to mind. And as I said, I think it has a lot to do with classic literature of the time. I don't think it's just subjective because I like that literature. But I think, you know, we have Dickens, we have Bronte, we have George Eliot. They all tackle themes of illness, themes of death in their works. There is so many characters that just like wither away and die. But also there is a lot of famous people from that era that we know that succumbed to the illness or struggled with that illness. I thought I would use Chopin as an example, but apparently people are debating whether or not it was tuberculosis or something else. So we also like to say that Victorians kind of romanticized consumption. I personally think it's a bit of an oversimplification. You know, there are stories of, oh, they were catching consumption on purpose, or wow, they were trying to look so hard like they had consumption, and they romanticized the consumption look. I think what really happened was, because it was so common and because art and literature of the era often had this sort of like dark undertone to it, it just became sort of a common trope. So someone years from now could say about us, oh, they had this weird obsession with vampires. You know, they had Twilight, they had the Vampire Diaries, they had multiple Dracula adaptations, and all of them were very loved by young people. And all young people wanted to be vampires and look like vampires, which, fair. But also, it's not like it's a well-known phenomenon that people go around wishing they were the undead, you know? So I think a similar thing happened with consumption. Obviously, there must have been some crazy people that were idealizing the illness, but it's probably no different to people nowadays being fascinated by death and graves and all that stuff. So it was probably the same type of people. So today we are reading a text from 1839. So Victoria was a queen for 2 years already. And the text's name is How to Prevent Consumption. And I think it gives really good insight into what they thought they knew about the disease or what knowledge was available at the time, because we love underlining how poor, you know, the medicine knowledge was at the time. But I think we tend to maybe overdo it and be like, yeah, they didn't know anything, just because they didn't grasp like the basics of hygiene and prevention that we know nowadays. I think it's easy to judge those people, whereas their actual knowledge is often surprisingly not that tragic. But sometimes it is. So let's jump into it. Of all the various punishments which a wise and good and merciful Father in heaven has seen fit to employ, to bring back to strict obedience to all his laws, natural and revealed, his erring creatures, none seems to us more striking than that wide wasting disease, pulmonary consumption. Right off the bat, it's our fault. We've been sinning, and God decided to punish us. That was the mindset of the era. Anything that happened in our lives was a consequence of our disobedience to God. Hardly any climate affords entire exemption from its ravages, though it is unquestionably much more common in some countries than in others. Nor is it wholly confirmed to particular age, constitution, sex, or circumstance. It is a scourge of transgression wherever transgression exists, especially in our own country. This book was published in the United States, by the way. Few parts of the world, if we except perhaps Great Britain, are more exposed to its terrible inroads than the United States, and in particular, New England. Did I also mention this book came out in Boston? The annual number of deaths in the United States from consumption has been variously estimated. Some suppose it not to exceed 40,000, while others place the number as high as 80,000. I actually need to check what the population was in 1839. It says in 1840 it was 17 million. The appropriate means and measures for preventing consumption are exceedingly numerous. We shall present a few of the leading and principal ones only, and those will be treated as briefly as the nature of the case will admit. Health of parents. Whatever promotes the general health of parents does so much towards preventing pulmonary consumption. And then they quote Dr. James Clark and his treatise on pulmonary consumption. Parents may transmit the tuberculous constitution to their children. Every member of the profession, by observing what is daily passing before him, may see numerous proofs of the truth of this statement. He will find many children presenting the tuberculous constitution, while no traces of it are to be observed in the parents. So what he's saying is that some people are naturally prone to tuberculosis and that it's inheritable. What I think makes a little sense is that if someone naturally has a lung disease or lungs that are in some sort of way weaker than the regular lungs, then it would make sense if it's genetic that his children are also going to be more prone to lung disease. But what do I know? I'm not a doctor. And then the second mean to preventing consumption, as they call it, is the health of children. Some may smile at the bare suggestion of the idea that one means of preventing consumption in an individual is to secure and preserve his health. Everyone, it will perhaps be said, knows this, without any information on the subject. But is it so after all? Is there not a sort of indefinite notion abroad that good health is not security against disease? True indeed, everyone knows that as long as a person is in health, he is not sick. And were we merely to say this, we might justly be regarded as trifling with our readers. But we mean much more. Is there not a general belief in our community that firm health invites disease instead of repelling it? What means the saying that the healthiest children are most likely to be attacked with croup, troubled with worms, etc.? The very idea that the most healthy are most liable to be sick, or that health invites or encourages disease and renders it more fatal, is in the very nature of things a contradiction in terms. It cannot be so. It certainly is not so. This part is so confusing because I cannot believe that they linked good health with bad health. It's just like, how can you even... Like, apparently they had maybe like superstition of the kind that if you had three children and one of them was very healthy, then that one child is gonna become ill. The mistake may have arisen, in part at least, from the fact that many individuals, children and adults, who appear fat and have red cheeks, have become the subjects of severe disease. Back then, obviously, being fat was a good thing. Like, I don't think they believed it was a source of any health issues. If you were a fat child, everyone was happy with you. And I think it went on quite long. Like, I know for sure, even my generation in Poland, like, if a grandma saw you and you were a fat kid, they would be like, wow, you look so good. Because obviously, they've seen malnutrition. So to them, it was far better to see a child be fat and happy than malnourished and weak. So, I mean, it makes total sense. Fat children, it is well known, are most liable to croup and several other diseases. Fat adults, too, are peculiarly liable to some forms of disease. And both children and adults who have red cheeks, and of whom it is so often said they are the very picture of health, most commonly labor under disease of some of the internal organs. Okay, interesting theory. If someone has red cheeks, they are basically withering inside. But also, it's interesting how red cheeks were seen as a symptom of health, mostly. Because I was wondering, okay, what did they mean by, oh, someone's healthy? And I thought they meant, oh, they never get ill. But apparently, they just meant they're fat and they have red cheeks and they look healthy. Now, the plain matter of fact is that the best preventive of disease in all the circumstances and conditions of life, from infancy to age, is good health. Let us labor to secure this, and just in proportion to our success will be our immunity from disease. The perfectly healthy person, whether child or adult, need not fear disease. No, not even the cholera, the plague, or the smallpox. Now, this is fundamentally untrue in the modern world because we know that diseases like this that spread around, and viruses basically, they don't necessarily discriminate. So with things like the plague, I'm pretty sure it made no difference whether the person was perfectly healthy. I mean, maybe they would survive some more and maybe they have bigger chances of survival, but at the end of the day, you never know how your body's going to react and you may have some underlying issues that you don't know about. And then the third mean to avoiding the consumption would be exemption from colds. Perhaps the most fruitful particular source of consumption is the habit of taking cold. There is somehow or other a deep sentiment everywhere prevailing, which counteracts all our teachings to the contrary, and which, notwithstanding all we have said, will be likely to haunt many of our readers, that diseases are sent upon us, that they are not the natural consequences of our misdeeds. So basically what they're saying is, you are responsible for your health, which is obvious to us, but back then, when they believed that God meddled with their lives in every possible way, it would be very easy to just be like, I don't care what I do, you know, it's up to God to decide whether I'm sick or healthy. Nowadays, I think even Christians have this philosophy that we need to take care of our bodies because they were given to us by God and, you know, neglecting them is a sin in itself. Back then, Apparently that was not really a thing. You would just be like, whatever God has in store. If this feeling could ever be driven from society, if it could ever be fully and practically believed that disease in every form is the natural consequence of transgressing the moral and physical, and especially the organic laws of the Creator, and if it should ever come to be a generally received opinion that a person in good health could no more be sick than a stone can swim or water run uphill, we should labor with more hope. However, we must toil on, hoping for the best. So, if you're sick, you deserved it, and it's a natural consequence of your moral choices, or God just hates you, or hates everyone around you, and that's why you got the disease. That was the common philosophy at the time. So they're saying if this thought, if this philosophy could be driven out of society, that would make things so much easier.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
A large proportion of our consumptive cases are either excited or aggravated, as we have already intimated, by colds. It may be induced by a large quantity of cold drink taken suddenly, when we are debilitated by fatigue or excess of heat, by currents of cooler air falling upon the body, when in a very warm place arid inactive, by similar currents falling upon a part of the body for some time in a warm room, as when we sit by a raised or broken window, by going out of heated rooms, perhaps fatigued, into the night air, especially without sufficient covering, by the application of cold, though it should not be inordinate, after we have been long exposed to a high temperature, and by cold itself when continued for a long time, as in traveling too long in a stagecoach during cold winter, sleeping too cold during the night, sitting with wet feet, etc. To avoid taking cold then, we must avoid these and the other causes which lead to it. I feel like this is a philosophy that our grandmas still love, or at least my grandmas, where if you spend too much time outside, if you sit on a cold stone, if you go out with your hair wet, you're gonna get a cold 100%. And there is some merit to it. Like, in general, if you change the temperature very fast, it's not great. If your body's already weakened by like fatigue, it might be easier to catch something, etc. But in general, I don't think it's as deep as people used to think. Plenty of good air. As the respiration of an impure atmosphere, says Dr. Clark, is one of the most powerful causes of tuberculous cachexia, so is the respiration of pure air an indispensable requisite for strumous children. Too much attention, therefore, cannot be paid to the construction and ventilation of the child's apartment. The room in which he sleeps should be large, the air should be frequently renewed, and his bed should not have more curtains than are necessary to protect him from the currents of air. We should prefer no curtains at all. Now, this is a Victorian dilemma because houses were so freaking cold. I mean, the rooms were massive, the walls were not insulated, the windows were shabby, all you had was 10 layers of duvets and curtains around your bed. And that was your best way of staying warm. You also had those like heaters that you would put in your feet. But other than that, you would not waste firewood over nighttime. And that was also dangerous to do. So you would basically sleep in unheated rooms most of the time in most of the cases. So What they're saying is don't cover your bed, make sure the windows are frequently opened and the air is coming in and out the room. Would that actually be beneficial? I don't know. But I mean, it's good to freshen up the room every now and then. I don't know how successful that will be in preventing consumption. Proper food and drink. Perhaps we have said enough of drink in speaking of the want of health in parents and the causes. Of food, in reference to the prevention of scrofula and consumption, Dr. Clark and other writers say much, but their testimony does not in every respect coincide. In two points, however, do they all agree, which are in confining those children who are in the least suspected of a predisposition to these diseases for two or three of their first years to a diet exclusively of milk and farinaceous vegetables. And in directing persons of this description of every age to use food which is plain and unstimulating. Food and drink of every kind for those predisposed to consumption should be cool. So long has common sense understood this, at least in part, that everyone warns the consumptive against indulging too freely in hot food, such as hot bread or biscuit. But they should not only avoid indulgence, they should not use it at all. That's interesting about the food being cool. I would have assumed they want the food to be hot to keep the person warm, since they're supposed to avoid cold. Another way of avoiding consumption, drumroll, physical and moral purity. A writer in the Boston Medical and Surgical Journal, Dr. Gold, about 3 years ago, insisted strongly on the tendency of physical indulgence to pulmonary consumption. On the subject to which we allude, even our physicians, as a general fact, are as yet but half awake, while the mass of the community are neither awake nor willing to be awaked. I am so intrigued right now because do they refer to sex, basically? Which would kind of make sense because a lot of saliva is transmitted in the process, so that does not sound like a good situation for someone that tries not to catch consumption, that's all I'm gonna say. And then proper dress. We have already alluded under another head to the evils of long-continued cold. It is necessary then to dress in such a manner if possible as to prevent such results. Okay, consumption-avoiding dress code, let's go. Exercise and clothing should, however, to the robust, be nearly sufficient. The enervating tendency of artificial temperatures, especially when these temperatures are high, as is often the case in our shops, factories, schoolrooms, nay, even our kitchens and parlors, is not well understood. Nor should we be credited, were we to endeavor to set it forth. Much is said on the necessity of flannel next to the skin, in the cool season. If such is our occupation, such are habits, and so imperfect our health that we cannot be always comfortable without flannel next to the skin, let it be thus used. Cotton flannel, as it is called, or indeed any sort of cotton, is better and safer for permanent use next the skin if we can get along with it without immediate discomfort than any woolen materials whatever. Okay, that's a hot take. Don't wear wool close to your skin, pick cotton instead. There is one never-failing source of pulmonary disease connected with dress, which, though often adverted to, should not be passed over. We allude to the custom of dressing in such a way as to impede the motion of the chest. It is of comparatively little consequence what the form of the dress is. If it hinders free motion and full expansion, it is always injuries. We cannot in a single short essay enter fully into this important subject. It is perhaps sufficient to say that every ounce of steady continued compression upon any part of the chest prevents the delicate organs within from doing their work as perfectly as they would otherwise do it, and that this tends to disease. How surprising we have the corset rant. Though, interestingly enough, maybe because A, it's supposed to be an elegant book, so it wouldn't deal with women's underwear. B, it's quite early on, 1839, the corsets were basically still stays that were not too tight. And C, maybe it's not actually about the corsets, but rather the whole upper body of women being constricted by garments. So basically, it wasn't even about the corsets. It could have been about the bodices of the dresses that would be quite tightly fitted at the time. And if you look at articles and books on dress reform from the Victorian era, they rarely focus just on the corsets. They often focus on the whole garment, like the bodice itself, how it fits around the armpits, how it fits around the neck, how you cannot raise your arms properly with your sleeves on. So I think that's what they're referring to here. Cleanliness. We cannot help thinking that the value of a clean skin as a means of preventing consumption has usually been underrated. Many people imbibe the notion that dirt, to the consumptive, is even healthful. It cannot be so. It is not so. This was written by a doctor. I'm gonna get his name at the end because I don't remember, but I wonder how many times in his life he had to listen to people say like, oh, I heard dirt is actually good for you when you have consumption. And he's like, no. This explains why daily cold bathing to those who are predisposed to consumption is so useful. There is an oily substance which is constantly exuded from the skin and which greases it over, and in a little time impedes perspiration unless we wash often. More than this, the dirt adheres to us and blocks up the openings of the skin, but washing removes the oil and dirt. Okay, skincare queen. Some good points and some bad points. I don't think dirt blocked your skin from breathing. Maybe keeping up with hygiene was a good idea for someone that was trying not to get consumption. And I mean, in general, any illness. Cold bathing is a controversial one, I think, because like they were already in freezing cold houses. And then you would also have a cold bath. I don't know. Or maybe actually a warm bath would be worse if you then entered a cold room. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a physician. I have no idea what I'm talking about. Proper exercise. This is an interesting one because throughout the Victorian era, everyone's like, oh, we have to exercise, we need to exercise. But they never did. The women never exercised. They were not even walking around the room. So everyone's like, wow, we really need to exercise more. And then they didn't do a thing until like late in the century, which I find really interesting. Due exercise of body and mind is indeed indispensable to all, but especially so to the consumptive. By due exercise, we do not, however, mean over-exercise. For he who, in avoiding the miseries of inaction, exercises beyond his powers or strength, is running on one rock to escape another. Let all the functions and faculties of body and mind both be duly employed from early life, especially the lungs. So they were like, guys, you need to exercise, but don't overdo it though. Like, don't over-exercise, but then we're never gonna tell you what to actually do. Health of mind. Interesting one. Hardly anything is worse for the consumptive than intense mental exertion. This operates to produce mischief in several ways. It almost always involves sedentary habits, which, as we have just seen, are of themselves hurtful. I think it's a common trope in Victorian literature that a character, usually female, is so upset by someone and is in so much pain mentally that she then proceeds to catch an illness and die, or almost die. And the fact that they're talking about it, it also means that it probably happened. Cheerfulness. I mean, wanna stop yourself from getting consumption? Just be happy. This is essential everywhere in life, but to none more so than to the consumptive. Be not anxious, that is, over-anxious, has to such persons a deep and important meaning. Would that it were understood so. A few generations following each other in succession, who should contrive to maintain unremitted cheerfulness, even if other causes were to remain the same, would banish 3/4 of our consumptive diseases from the world. Guys, I found a cure. You just need to smile. Peace of conscience is another one. This is not easily separable from general cheerfulness. He who has the latter will at the same time almost inevitably possess the former, while he who has peace of conscience will sooner or later become cheerful. Okay, I mean, that's one way to look at it. Just stay positive, you guys. Don't forget to smile. And should the time ever arrive, as we doubt not it will, when Christianity shall be fully applied, as its author no doubt intended it should be, to the whole condition and renovation of men, physical and intellectual no less than moral, the greater part, if not the whole of the diseases which prevail in the world, will be banished, except from the pages of history. Wouldn't that slap? I mean, that would be the dream, right? To just get rid of all the diseases. And according to, let me check his name, according to Dr. W.M.A. Alcott, okay, interesting, that time will come when we finally start behaving like Christians. It's interesting because he's obviously a physician, so he's trying to balance this like very scientific approach with his faith and with the fact that most people reading the book will be Christians and will be people of faith. And I find it interesting because he's like trying to fight a lot of stereotypes that I think Christians at the time could be like, wow, so you do not believe that God is almighty and can send a disease on you? So I imagine he must have had a lot of conversations when he would just like roll his eyes and be like, these people will never learn. But at the same time, not all of his advice is obviously good. I mean, I always get a little sad when I read medical texts from history because they really did their best. I mean, you can tell that they were really trying to not die. And it's just a bit sad because we now have all the knowledge that they were missing. And I wonder like what they would do if they were transported in time to here and they would be like, oh my God, so this is how it worked. Like I knew it the whole time. I would love for them to have that experience, especially if what they were saying was not necessarily harmful. They were just like literally trying to survive and trying to make the people that they were caring for survive, which is like even sadder probably because they were not always successful. Those are the thoughts I have on the topic. Let me know what you guys have. If there are any physicians out there that could enlighten us on the topic of consumption and how it works and how they thought it works instead, please let us know in the comments. That would be so interesting to read. And don't forget to check out my Patreon at patreon.com/textree for some goodies, baby. Okay, I'll hear you in another one. Bye.
Time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.